Saba Youssef.
Hey.
She calls herself a disruptor. Like me, you are an English to Dubai transplant. You were born in London.
Yeah, born and raised in London.
That's it. Thanks for listening, everybody. What was it like for you growing up with an entrepreneurial father?
I had to go into the office with my dad on school holidays.
Did you enjoy it?
No, I hated it. I thought it was my punishment.
Did you always know you wanted to be in business as a kid?
I started a business in school selling popcorn.
Oh, really?
My popcorn was doing so well that actually the cafeteria was losing business.
What's been your biggest disaster that you've invested in?
There was this one guy. I always knew there was something dodgy about him.
You're a black belt in martial arts?
In karate, yeah.
Really?
Why are people surprised when they hear this?
Not because you're a Pakistani woman. But,
no.
But you don't still train anymore?
No.
You've got a gun instead.
Yeah.
Wait till you see the edit of this.
I know.
Guys, Matt Haycock's here, and welcome to another episode of The Matt Haycock Show, where today I have a very special guest. We're here in Dubai with a good friend of mine, Saba Youssef.
Hey.
She is an entrepreneur, an investor. She calls herself a disruptor, so we're gonna talk about that soon. She's definitely one of the best connected people I've ever come across, and I'm looking forward to having a good chat. I always say that I love talking to friends because I just think it's an easier dynamic, isn't it?
You know,
I mean, even though normally when you're talking to someone who's been on podcasts, they've got, they know how to talk, they know how to make you feel at ease, but it's just always different when it's someone you know. But when I knew we were doing this, I thought it's actually quite interesting because as much as we've chatted or kind of like known each other over the last 9 or 12 months, I still never really get to actually know much about you.
That's because every time we meet, we just chat shit and we just laugh for hours on end. So we never get to the serious stuff.
So today's like for my own personal benefit. Yeah. It might not even make the cut. I'm just going to ask you a load of questions that I've always wanted to
Fire
ask.
Away.
No. Well, look, let's start at the beginning for my benefit and for everybody else's, because obviously, like me, you are an English to Dubai to Dubai transplant, but you were born in London.
Yeah, born and raised in London.
That's it.
I thought there was a follow-on question that was more interesting.
Everybody.
Okay, let me start from the beginning.
That was going to set the scene.
My grandfather, I was born and raised in London. My parents are from Pakistan. So they were born in Pakistan, but they came to London when they were quite young, I think around 5. They were also raised in London. So I almost feel like I'm second generation British. Went to school in central London. And then last year we moved to Dubai. My father and I moved to Dubai. But I had been coming to Dubai for about 15 years anyway. So it almost felt like my home already.
What brought your family to England in the first place?
Just to save tax, to be honest. I mean, you know, people they have some other reasons, but...
So not Dubai, to England from India?
Oh, from Pakistan.
Pakistan.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
I'm just demonstrating my terrible geography.
Same thing. That's a good question. So I think my grandparents, they wanted to migrate to the UK just to have a better life for their kids. Better education, better business opportunities. So my mum's family, they had money when they moved.
Already, when they came.
My dad's family had practically nothing. He's totally self-made.
In England?
In England. So my family business, my dad and my uncle, we call them Jacha, are in real estate construction. And I'm sure you know loads of Pakistani and Indians in the UK. It's kind of what they did.
I can say yes to that question.
Yes. It's kind of what they did. When they moved to the UK, a lot of Jewish people, a lot of Pakistanis, they kind of went into the construction or property development business because it was just a solid business in the 60s.
And what was it like for you, I guess, you know, growing up with an entrepreneurial father, you know, in that business world? I mean, did you always know you wanted to be in business as a kid?
Since I can remember.
Really?
Because I saw it at home. So my mother is a lawyer. She's super clever. I picked up a lot from her. And my dad's entrepreneurial spirit definitely rubbed off on me because I like risk. The idea of risk is exciting to me in my work life, not my personal life.
Okay.
just clarifying. So I have to balance it out, you see. So I love
risk. You play risk safe and you play to laugh, yeah?
Which is why I'm single. And I love risk. And because you get to see it at home growing up, you know that it's achievable for you. So I always knew it was in my grasp because I saw my dad achieve it.
Do you see yourself, like, can you see yourself in your father? Like, I guess by that, I mean, my dad was an entrepreneur. He had his own business. Yeah. And I guess it must have been something that rubbed off on me as well, because, you know, I guess I'd watch him. He'd always bring staff home for training sessions. I'd always get taken on work, dinners and stuff. So I was always surrounded by and immersed in that. Yeah. But as a business person myself, you know, I guess even when I started in 18, 19, 20, I've always been very different, you know, very different to him, you know, and particularly today as our stars have developed. I mean, we're probably very, very different business operators, but obviously, you know, I guess the bones of what I did, you know, must have started back in those days.
Yeah, I think my father and I are very similar people, but as you said, our styles are different, and that's purely just a generational thing. So I expect my kids will have different styles to me. And this is also evolution, right? Every generation is meant to get better and do better. Otherwise, why are we here?
But you didn't start in business straight away. You went to uni, and I'm going to say you worked at one of the big four. Doing?
International tax. Okay. So I did the graduate program. So in my penultimate year of university, you do the summer internship. Then if they like you, if they're impressed, then they offer you a job straight out of uni. So I did that. I was at Ernst & Young for 2 years. I worked on the international tax desk. So I had two clients mainly that I looked after. I don't know if I'm allowed to say. It's been years. Yeah, so I looked after Philip Green's account and Simon Cowell.
Okay.
So I was on their team, and I just got really good at saving people tax. It was my one skill set that I learned at EY, but more than that, I learned discipline at EY. I was up at 5 every day, in the gym, in the office, deliverables. I really learned a lot of discipline.
And what was the plan then? Was that going to be a stepping stone to something else? You know, were you just wanting to learn about tax and get some grounding?
I don't know what 20-year-old wants to learn about tax. I definitely didn't. But my dad is a chartered accountant. So in our family, we have a rule in the family business, which is a joint family business because a lot of the brothers were involved. Okay. That the kids have to go to university, they have to study. We were given a choice of all professional things like economics, accountancy, doctor, dentist, whatever. And then we had to work in industry for a few years if you wanted to be invited to join the family business.
Oh, okay.
So it's almost part of the contract. And at the time, I didn't understand it. Now, I mean, I'll definitely make my kids do this. It was a huge learning opportunity for me, and I wouldn't be the same if I hadn't worked in industry for a few years before starting my own industry.
My parents, my mum particularly, was very, very education driven, very uni driven, and I was like completely against it. I mean, obviously, not that anyone would believe it, but I'm a bit older than you. And in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, it was very much a time where never mind, let's say your family's rules for the business, mm-hmm. just in society in general, if you didn't go to uni, particularly if you'd come from a good family, if you'd been to private school and then didn't go to uni, it was very much considered that you were a failure, that you'd let the family down.
And absolutely.
I think because my mum had pneumonia when she was like 16. She'd never been able to go and do the education herself. She kind of wanted to live it through my eyes as well. And they were adamant that I'd go to uni. And I was just desperate to do anything possible not to go to uni. So as a kind of a 13, 15, 16-year-old, I'd spend every weekend at the markets, buying and selling any old crap. I mean, back then I was, I remember buying and selling blow-up cushions, blow-up sofas, Tamagotchi pets, toilet rolls, literally anything to try and make my fortune so I didn't have to go to uni. But it never happened. And so I'd started uni, and the deal at the time was going to be that I would work alongside going to university. Yeah. And I thought, well, that's a decent compromise for me. But my problem was I saw all my friends going to uni who had like 8 hours a week of work to do, and all the rest of the time they were just getting pissed. So I thought, well, in the time they're getting pissed, I can go and work. I walk into uni on day one, and I get handed like 20 books that are this thick, courses for like 20 hours a week, 30 hours a week. I thought there's just no way that I can do the two. So I after about 6 weeks, I managed to convince my parents to let me leave.
Oh,
but,
wow.
because there was a family business I was going to go and work in at the time. And I said, well, look, let me work in this business and, you know, give me a year. And if it all goes wrong, then I can go back to uni in the end. It's just consider it a gap year. Then the deal was if I did leave, I had to do my CEMA, you know, my accountancy. So I did actually start that on the kind of distance Great. Learning and then managed to find a way to...
It became more distant.
Jack that one in as well.
Oh, is it interesting? Yeah. I mean, I think my education, I wouldn't say it taught me a lot, if I'm being honest. And I think I pursued education because my parents probably felt the same way as your parents. And at that time, yes, people were education snobs. But things have changed now. It didn't teach me many facts. I could easily learn that from a textbook or online. But it did teach me about life, I feel. It taught me how to compute very quickly. It taught me how to remember things very quickly. It taught me how to manage time pressure, schedules, and deadlines. It taught me how to interact with other people. Because in high school, I mean, it's just really not real life. You don't really understand life. And when you go to university, things, your eyes do open up. So I think there are many pros to higher education. It's not just a complete waste.
But when you said a minute ago that you'd want to do the same with your kids, yeah. Exactly the same. So the deal would be you've got to do the education to A levels. You've got to do the uni.
And I would say at least A levels or that level, whether it's international baccalaureate, whatever country they're in. But about the strict family constitution thing, I think I might be more lenient. So it was from the age of about 8. I had to go into the office with my dad on school holidays.
Every day?
Mm. And we were only allowed to travel on a portion of my, say, Christmas holiday, but the rest of the days I had to be in my dad's office. And I had to make people tea and file papers and photocopy things and learn. That is something I will definitely make my kids do.
Did you enjoy it?
No, I hated it. I felt it was my punishment. But those skills I learned from such an early age helped me through life. When I compare myself to my classmates, I could navigate through life way easier than them because I was trained at a very early age.
So at what point then from hating it at 8 to then kind of knowing since you were a kid that you wanted to be in business, what was a turning point?
I think I was about 14 in high school and I started to understand costs of goods sold, margins, profits, and life started making sense to me. I realized that making money is just about finding the delta. That's all it is. It doesn't need to be that complicated. So I started a business in school selling popcorn.
Oh, really?
Has a really high margin, by the way. Really high. And I would just bring it in, you know, every morning fresh and people loved it. And the margins were very high. And my popcorn was doing so well that actually the cafeteria was losing business. Yeah.
So my school popcorn / tuck shop story was not wildly dissimilar. Actually, I never brought it in, but we had this tuck shop at school.
Yeah.
Where they sold, you know, pasties and Mars bars or whatever it was, and it used to open at whatever break time was, say half past 10. It would open from 10:30 until 10 to 11, but the queue was always around the door. So if you didn't get to the beginning of the queue, you know, you'd spend your whole time queuing. And if you were too far back in the queue, you wouldn't even get served anyway. Mm. So what I used to do was about 5 minutes before the lesson finished each day, I'd pretend I needed to go to the toilet, run down to the tuck shop, and I'd be the first person in the queue. Yeah. And I'd go and buy as much as I could afford, you know, like 20 quid of the stuff, 30 quid of the stuff, and then take it back up to the classroom and sell it at double the price for people who didn't want to have to queue.
Genius.
So
genius. I love that.
So obviously you've done the education, done the Ernst & Young because that was the family rule. Yeah. Was the plan then that you were going to go and work with your dad?
Yeah, the family business, which was real estate construction. And I started and I really didn't enjoy it. I didn't quite understand it. I didn't feel passionate about it. I wasn't excited
about the sector.
To wake up in the morning and go to work. I didn't feel motivated by the job, looking for plots of land and, you know, speaking with surveyors on how to get planning permission to build upon it and rent it out after or sell it. It just didn't appeal to me. And my dad really, really wanted it to appeal to me, especially because I have no brothers. So I was the son that he never had.
So how long did you give it?
A year.
And then?
And then I begged him to give me a loan to let me start my own thing.
We fought.
Well, that's a good question, because at the time I didn't even know what you called it. I just knew that I loved science. And I would read about science. It was my bedtime reading, my morning reading. I was just fully immersed into learning about science. So I had no idea how to make money from this. So I was begging my dad to let me go do science, but I didn't even know what that would look like. I just knew that I needed money to try and find out how to even make a business out of science, where to start. I mean, I was young, I was naive, but I knew that I had a passion. So he eventually did give me a very small loan, because he thought I was going to lose it. And I did lose most of it. But I managed to generate some sales from one of my investments, and I just grew it from there.
And when you got the loan off him, did you have an actual plan that it was going into?
Yeah. I mean, he sat me down. He made the plan with me. You know, my father taught me a lot.
And did he work in the business with you, or just leave it?
No, sometimes I would call upon him for advice. But because my dad and I are quite similar, we can't work together. We just bicker. So we try to keep our work lives separate.
So the first science business, what was it? What did it do?
It was a company called Clever Calories. So it was a cake bar that was healthy. And back in the day, because we're so old, people had only started to research and become enticed by ingredients that can help speed up your metabolism, help your muscle growth, things like L-carnitine. And I obviously had been researching this for many years before that, because I was just genuinely interested. So I managed to find a manufacturer who would put these ingredients into this bar, and we sold it as a health food bar that sped up your metabolism. And we launched in Harvey Nichols. I think they had a 6-month exclusivity with me across all the 7 Harvey Nichols stores in the UK. And we just grew it from there. And then I sold the company way too early. That was my mistake, but I was just so flattered that someone wanted to buy a company that I created. So I sold it and I moved on to my next.
So on that first one, was your sole distribution at the time through Harvey Nichols?
Yeah, so it was an exclusive launch with Harvey Nichols. And I didn't know anything about distribution either. So I was sitting there in my bedroom for weeks emailing people, you know, just trying to catch a break. And I always had samples out and whatever. And they received my samples and they loved it. And they asked for exclusive distribution in return for launching me.
I mean, it's not a bad partner to have as your first distribution partner.
I was extremely flattered. And, you know, back then it was easier because people's phone numbers and emails were on the internet. They were on LinkedIn. Now, I believe getting distribution contracts is a lot trickier. It's more competitive.
So what was the next one? Next thing you moved on to?
So then I started looking into deep science, disruptive science. Yeah. And I became involved with an R&D company in Europe.
Just before we go into it, disruptive science, what would you mean by that?
So I would say that, look, disruption is when you are changing the way things are done for the better, hopefully. Mm-hmm. So if you look at disruptive science, it's stuff that we know that we can help the world with, help human health with. And it's a bit ahead of its time. So people like me who are enticed by disruption, we get in a very early stage, we develop that science, and then we deploy it around the world or to clients where it fits. But we're very cutting edge, very innovative, which is also, it can be tricky sometimes, because sometimes you're too soon. It's too disruptive and the world is not quite ready for your technology.
And just for people listening, I mean, give us some examples, not of so much of your product, but maybe products that we would know on the street, like I guess an Elon Musk would be a disruptor, would he?
I think a lot of business people are disruptors. Look, with Elon, he started disrupting very early with software. You know, what he did for PayPal, what he's doing for AI, of course, electric vehicles. It was a new market. I'll give you another example, the iPad. Mm-hmm. It was never a product. They actually invented a product and sold it to us. That is disruption.
So go back to your product.
I'll give you an example of something that I disrupted quite recently. So I invested in a coating. Okay. It's an invisible coating. It's a spray. You can spray it onto anything. And it will bind to that surface for 1 year. It can be your clothes, your phone, an airplane, whatever. And it stays for 1 year. Even if you wash it or you put alcohol in it, it will stay on that surface for 1 year. And on top of the surface, there are these ROSs, sort of free radicals. And they actually destroy the methane in the air. They grab the methane and they destroy it. So it's actually cleaning up greenhouse gases. And obviously methane is the most potent greenhouse gas, the most dangerous. I thought I was going to save the world. Really, I thought I was going to sell this company for $10 billion because it's so simple, well, to me. And then we put it out on the market and I realized no one understands it. No one wants to understand it. And everyone has bought their, you know, greenhouse gas emission contracts for the next 10 years. No one was interested in buying my product. So I thought I had just wasted a few million dollars in a few years of my life. I thought, what do I do? I've lost it. It's useless. So I had to think. I thought, okay, Savs, come on. How are you going to disrupt this? How are you going to get this out there and make your money back at least? And I thought, what do people do every day so I don't have to change their purchase psychology to persuade them to buy my product? Because they're just not interested in what I have to say. And I thought about laundry detergent. So we put this molecule into laundry detergent. Everyone uses laundry detergent. When you put it in the wash, it binds to your clothes and it stays there until you wash it again. So you can use a laundry detergent that has my molecule inside it and you're walking around living your life. Don't worry about me. Don't think about me. But you're cleaning up the environment because your clothes are now working for the environment. Okay. So I don't need you to do the work to clean up the environment. So that's how I turned it into a product that can actually get out there and do what I wanted it to do, which is to reduce greenhouse gases.
As someone who now invests in this kind of stuff, how often do you see tech or, let's say, disruption being used for the sake of disruption and actually, you know, like fixing a problem that's not there? And, and just to give a bit of context to the question, I've had investments in and started fintech businesses over the last few years. And, you know, fintech, I would say, is a disruptive sector. Yeah. But what I tend to find, my expression is always, the problem with fintech is that there's too much tech and not enough fin. Mm. And what you tend to find is it's people taking trying to put a tech wrapper around a financial business, you know, just for the sake of getting a valuation, or, you know, they might make a beautiful peer-to-peer lending was a market I'm in, and they'll have a beautiful platform that, you know, connects the investors with the borrowers, and they can say they do it better than the next one connects the investors with the borrowers. But ultimately, what really matters is how high quality are the loans, you know, that people are investing in, or, you know, does the platform Absolutely. Know what to do when things go wrong? And I often see that, I believe that, you know, too often people try and fix a problem that doesn't exist with, you know, by just wrapping tech around it and trying to get a valuation. I mean, do you see that a lot yourself?
Okay, so I did see a lot of that about 10 years ago, 8 years ago. Now I feel people are picking up on this model. I think we have become smarter as investors and potential customers. So this plan that people are trying to do is becoming less successful. Thank God. I think now we can spot that much easier.
So when you invest in a business now, I mean, do you still start your own, or do you just like to invest?
I haven't started my own in quite a while. To be honest, I prefer to have stakes in many different businesses that I align with and I can add value to. So I haven't actually founded my own company by myself in a long time. I love having partners. It's more minds. We learn from each other. The output is way better in my experience.
And what makes a great founder? You know, what makes a great business idea for you to invest in someone?
Well, you see, they're two different things to me. A great founder is different to a great business idea, because I've seen amazing business ideas with really poor quality founders. I think as a founder, you have to have integrity and you have to at least want to be authentic, because then you stay true and loyal to what's best for the business, not what's best for you. And over the years, I've also been able to now learn how to gauge an integral founder compared to someone that's maybe just trying to make a quick buck.
And how do you gauge that? I mean, is it just gut, or
it's my gut feeling? And I know what questions to ask. Like, why why are you in this space? Why did you want to get into this space? What are your plans? And then if you hear, oh, exit strategy, oh, this, that, and it's going to be this valuation, I literally just walk away. Not interested.
Are you tending to be investing in first-time founders?
Oh, all of it. Yeah, I'm actually agnostic to that. I don't mind napkin ideas, even. I don't mind very early ideas. That's probably when it's most exciting for me. And I love mature businesses as well because you have the proof of concept. So if I feel I can invest in something where I know I can help scale it, then I would be involved in a mature business. I don't mind. If obviously you're going it at a more expensive cost.
And when you say you like to add value, what are your skill sets? What do you bring to the table to value add?
So I feel that my skill set is not necessarily being able to scale a business, because I think there are other experts in that field. My network, I think, is quite helpful. And also, I've always liked looking at data, making inferences from that data, and then reaching a conclusion. So my mind computerizes things that way. I think in numbers. I don't think in English. I think that is where my skill set is. So I can look at a business and I can download an idea that other people probably wouldn't. And I can maybe merge it with another business, think of distribution in this country, get a better price in this way, all because I kind of think in numbers. So I look at a business as one part of a formula. And I'm just trying to do 1 + 1 = 2.
What's been your biggest disaster, your biggest failure that you've invested in?
I mean, I have so many.
Go on. what did you learn from it?
There was this one guy that I invested in. Well, we invested the same amount together into a business in the States.
Who, you and this guy?
Mm-hmm. And I always knew there was something dodgy about him, but I was being greedy at the time because the deal just seemed really good. The business seemed great. So I ignored my gut intuition. And he ended up faking his death.
What?
Yeah, I'm not joking. He ended up faking his death. I'm trying to actually remember exactly what happened. And he moved somewhere. He escaped somewhere. I don't know where he is. And he left me with all the legal problems.
Did he work? Was it his business or he was just an investor?
We were both shareholders.
Right.
And there were other shareholders as well. So he faked his death, escaped the country, signed some dodgy documents that left me in a pickle, and I had to pick up the pieces. He emptied the bank accounts, everything. And what I learned from that is, even if it's your friend, put everything into a contract, because you just never know. You know, we tend to be lenient when there are friends, or if you chat every day, you just don't know. So put everything into a contract so there's no gray area. Everything is black and white.
Do you think in hindsight, you know, the more you learn about the world, the more you learn about people, would you have identified that problem with that guy? Like when you look back, do you go, oh God, it was obvious he was a total fraudster?
Yeah. And a lot of people told me as well. Again, I ignored everyone's advice, my own advice, because I was just looking at the dollar signs. The deal was just very good.
And what's been your best deal?
What's been my best deal? Do you mean financially or fulfillment-wise?
Both.
I would say it's... So my business up till recently has all been B2B. So you probably wouldn't have even heard of random biotech things that I've invested in. So last year I made a decision to invest in B2C brands.
Why?
Because it was my new challenge. I knew nothing about the B2C market. I didn't understand FMCG. I didn't understand retail. I didn't understand marketing. And I wanted to learn. I wanted to push myself. So I invested in a health company called Fix. I actually co-founded it with a few friends, one of them being a celebrity, because it's always cool to have a celebrity back brand from a marketing perspective. And I've had the most fun in this company. Working with these two minds, I've learned so much. We have really created something beautiful, because I've always felt that it's the 1% of wealth that gets to be in the 1% of health. And I've never understood this. Everyone deserves the right to health, to health equity. But why is it so expensive? So we've made a product line that transfers deep science into basic products that everyone can afford. So that's probably what I'm the most proud of.
Do you think it'll end up being the most financially rewarding?
I don't know yet, actually. I haven't crunched the numbers on...
Is it out? Are the products
it's
out?
It's launching in a few months. Okay. Yeah, we've been working on it for about 3 years. And I think this is what's going to make the most impact in the world, which ultimately is where happiness lies for me. And I understand that people need to make money. Of course, we're not running a charity. But I think when people say money brings you happiness, what I've learned is that I agree. Money does bring you happiness when you give it away. It's such a fulfilling feeling. And
let me make you happy.
What's up? Give me money.
I'm ready to receive.
So yeah, that's my learning, and I'm really excited for this project because I get to make impact.
Now, there's a lot, I would say, too much spoken about, you know, the problems for women in business, or, you know, diversity, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. ethnic minorities, etc.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, as someone who's young, who's Pakistani, who's a woman, how often do you see, or how often have you suffered from this, or what do you see?
In my 20s, I'm 35 now.
It's all like deep science. I know. Rewinding the clock.
All my money's on my face. In my 20s, I got a lot. Honestly, a lot of sexual discrimination. I've never felt discrimination because of my race. But I think that's because maybe people don't know where I'm from, or maybe it's different for women. But sexual discrimination all the time. It started at Ernst & Young. It carried on. Now in my 30s, I have less because people in my industry know me now, so they respect me. And also I know how to handle it better. So if I walk into a room and the men or women are not giving me the respect that I think I deserve as a basic right, I no longer take it personally. I just kind of get on with my job, and eventually everything evens out. I think things are getting better because people are more mindful, but when it happens to you, it's really hard.
Do you not find, I guess it's probably a leading question because it's my opinion. I've been having this conversation a few times recently with people. I mean, one of my business partners who's moved over to Dubai recently, I mean, she's 28 and obviously a female because it's a she.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was having the conversation recently about, you know, how have you felt treated? And I guess, you know, where we got to on the point was, yes, I've been discriminated initially because I'm young or because I'm a woman, but very quickly when people know that it's clear what I'm talking about, they switch. And I guess, you know, like I said, it's a leading question because that would be my view as well. I mean, ultimately, if a guy is discriminating because it's a woman, or if an older person is looking down on a younger person, if within the minute or two of talking to them it's become clear they know what they're talking about, if you continue to discriminate, then ultimately you're just a fucking idiot, aren't you? Because you're doing yourself down by
I do agree with you. I do. But imagine being in your 20s, being a young woman, trying to navigate life, and then every week you're being judged, or you're being spoken down to, or you're being patronized because you walk into a room full of men and women that treat you like you're stupid just because of your appearance or because you're a woman. So if it happens to you so many times, you really do start believing it. It can be really crushing. So eventually, yes, it's nice to get to that place where we are at now, but the journey is tricky. I won't sugarcoat it. I mean, what did you think of me when you first met me? I don't think we even had an introduction. Our common friend introduced us at Arts. Just be honest, what was your, you know, original...
I mean, I genuinely, I mean,
didn't care.
Too busy laughing.
Like, whatever.
Just wanted to get another glass of that red wine. I mean, you know, obviously you were busy. We were trying to talk and you were busy hosting multiple other people as well. Yeah. But, you know, I guess I found the beginning of an interesting conversation.
That's amazing. That means you were neutral.
That's what it was.
You didn't judge me, which is amazing.
But I find myself a neutral person. I don't discriminate against it. And that's why I look, I know it's easy for me to say as a white male that I don't like things to do with discrimination, things to do with ethnic minorities. But that's because I know from a personal perspective that, you know, I've hired everybody from young to old. Yeah. You know, I've got probably more women employees in key positions than men, you know. black, brown, disabled guy, everything. You know, I don't give a monkey's where you know where anyone comes from, because I want the best people for the job.
Absolutely.
And I, you know, I hate the concept of forcing diversity, because ultimately it's not a true representation anyway. You know, like when you look at the movies now, and there's five people in a friendship group, for example, and, you know, one's white, one's black, one's disabled, one's a transgender.
Yeah.
I think, hang on a minute, that's supposed to be a representation of society. There is not 20% black people, 20% transgender lesbians. You know, it's just... But again, it's easy for me to say, knowing that I behave in the right way. I'm sure if you are the minority and you're used to being subjected to to unfair behaviour,
you can get a little bit jaded. I mean, I definitely was in my 20s.
So at the beginning of this, I said I was looking forward to asking about things that I didn't know. I didn't know about all these questions, and even this is something I never knew to ask until today. But you're a black belt in martial arts,
in karate,
Really?
Yeah. Why are people surprised when they hear this?
Not because you're a Pakistani woman. No.
Disclaimer.
No, I guess. Those kind of things you always think.
No,
I
get it.
You're a martial artist.
Yeah, people do get shocked. So I started when I was very young, and it was my parents who forced me to do it against my will. But they were trying to, like I said, they moved to the UK because they wanted better for their children and their children's children. So they're just trying to create good quality kids, you know, well-rounded kids that have discipline. And it taught me a lot of discipline, because my karate teacher was scary as hell. Like, you cannot get anything wrong. You have to go 3 times a week, wake up early. But I actually can't defend myself. Yeah, I wouldn't even know how to. But the mental agility and strength that it teaches you was incredible. Because
how long did it take you to get to black belt?
I want to say 10 years.
Oh,
something like that.
But you don't still train anymore?
No. No, I finished, and you can go to first dan, second dan. But I think just life happened. GCSEs, A-level, stuff like that.
You got a gun instead.
Yeah. Did you say that because I'm Pakistani?
Wait till you see the edit of this.
I know.
No, I'm gonna spin it very woke.
We're woke.
Tell me some other things that would surprise me or surprise someone else, and like karate.
So people get quite surprised when they hear that I'm an introvert, and I don't know why. I really, really love to be alone, because when I'm alone, it's my ultimate peace. And for me, peace is the ultimate luxury in life. And yes, I'm very busy in my work. I work with teams. I do a lot of public speaking. I do a lot of podcasts. I go to events, but it's weird. I always feel like I'm actually alone in them. So me being alone is my happy space. And people just assume that I'm this very social, extroverted character. I'm honestly the complete opposite.
I mean, I would say I'm probably similar in that respect. I often describe myself as an antisocial extrovert. You know, listen, if I'm on duty, I'm on duty.
Right.
And I, you know, whether that's talking now or you know, working a room or doing business. But my true happy place is sat with a Nando's on my own, reading a book or watching Netflix.
Same.
So which is why I'm always banging heads with my missus, because she's the absolute opposite. She wants to be out 24/7. I never want to leave the house, and she keeps telling me that watching Netflix and having a takeaway does not mean that we're doing something together. Oh. I'll even let you pick the Netflix.
You're so kind.
How have you found investing, obviously, with the economy over the last few years, you know, and I guess that we're, for context for anyone listening, we're October, November 2023, you know, very much in the conversations of recession. I mean, I personally, you know, whilst I absolutely believe utter carnage is coming, I don't really think we've scratched the surface in where we're at. I mean, it's a big talking point, but I don't really think anyone's felt the pain of what's to come. I mean, how have you seen things affect you, or what's your take on where we're going?
Yeah, I mean, some of my businesses have slowed down this year and we are being patient. We will wait for the economic cycle to pick up and then we start all over again. But to be honest, when there is a recession, I notice that businesses become more authentic, which is nice because you're almost forced to be involved in more authentic businesses because now we focus on the real pain points. I mean, you just gave me 10 pain points in your question. Recession, what to do about this, what to do about that. You know, all of these things are potential businesses because if you're fixing a pain point, you're helping someone that needs your help. Like business doesn't have to be complicated. So when the economy is going down, people need help. When the economy is going up, people need help. It's just about finding the solution to the problem.
Have you come up with or invested in any businesses over the last year or so that have been recession problem specific? Or
no, so it's probably older investments that were more old school businesses. I've noticed since Brexit, since the Russia-Ukraine war, I've noticed that business has really gone down. And it's something that you just cannot control. We were expecting it. But like I said, you have to be patient. You have to ride it out if you can and then wait for it to pick up again.
I do think one of the benefits of doing business during tough times or you know of being finding it harder to raise funds during recessions, etc., is it does make, I mean you use the word authentic, but I also say makes people more creative, more real, because
absolutely,
you know, particularly when you're getting tens, hundreds of millions of venture capital money chucked at you.
Exactly.
And we see these horror stories of, you know, business raised X amount of money and was out of business a year later.
Yeah.
But you know, that same business could have been created for 90% less capital. I mean, obviously we're talking different scale of numbers here, but I see business plans from people who want me to invest all the time. Well, I look at this plan and, for example, they're saying, well, I need 250 grand to launch this business. And when you start looking at it, you say, well, hang on a minute, like, you know, you're renting an office, you're hiring 5 staff, you know, you're doing this, that, and the other. I mean, you haven't even sold a single product yet. You know, if you actually pare this down and cut all the fat out, cut all the shit out, you can probably do it for 50 grand, not 250 grand. Mm-hmm. And then you don't need me. Then you've not given up any equity. You know, you go and do some bootstrapping, and whether it's a 50 grand conversation, a 500 million pound conversation, it's you know, it's just the same. And I think, you know, people say how difficult it is to raise money in these markets, etc., which obviously it is, but I don't think that has to mean that people couldn't be and shouldn't be starting businesses in these markets, because if anything, it's just a chance to do it, you know, to do it more on a shoestring and actually own more of the business and build a real business.
I mean, well said. And I actually have created a business with some co-founders for under £50,000. And I'm not legally allowed to say what business it is yet. I will definitely talk about it when I can. But we created this business actually in under £50,000. We used AI. We used a bunch of amazing websites. I'm gonna list it all on my social media or something like that, because I want to spread the news.
Was this a particular challenge then, to come up with a sub 50 grand business? It just happens that it was done for less than 50 grand.
I wanted to do it for free. That was the initial goal. I didn't quite get there. So if you don't count our time spent, then yeah, we use AI. We use a number of websites. We use YouTube. We have hired people that are working on commission only once the company launches, and we have created a fully fledged, soon to be operational online business for under £50,000. And I'm sure in a year I can cut that in half.
How long have you been using AI for?
2 years.
Wow, long time.
Yeah, I can't live without AI.
Tell me your top 2 or 3 AI applications.
Okay, so Opus Clips.
Oh, that's for video editing.
Yeah, I just put it in. And I tell them what I want the video to be about, some rough keywords, and they will chop it up into lengths that I want, one long video, say this podcast, and they'll give me 30 clips that really make sense and full sentences, great visuals, and you get 30 different points made from one podcast video.
Wow.
Yeah. My social media manager uses it a lot. Opus, I love. And Midjourney. Do you use Midjourney?
No. You've
got to get on it.
I mean, I use a bit of ChatGPT, obviously, and Google Bard. But I just haven't learned enough Midjourney. But Molly, who runs a lot of our marketing and social media related stuff, I've said to her a few times over the last few weeks, got to get on that Midjourney, because one of the things we always struggle for in business, I'm sure most businesses do, is imagery, you know, and every PDF, every website is only, it doesn't matter how good your design is, it's only really as good as the imagery that sits behind it. And stock imagery just is crap stock imagery. And, you know, once you can get your head around Midjourney, the kind of stuff you can come up with is just, never mind stuff that can be done quicker. It will be imagery that no small business would ever have the budget to have access to that kind of stuff before.
Exactly. It's also very inspirational. If you put the right prompts into Midjourney, it can even think for you and create imagery that you don't even know your brand needs. So that was one of the websites we used to create this company in under £50,000.
Oh, really?
Midjourney. I created our logo on there, all the artwork, and even the packaging files, all on Midjourney. And if you contact a graphic designer, they are about 100 times the price of what we paid on Midjourney. I really mean it, 100 times the price of what you pay on Midjourney. You just have to know the right prompts.
When you pay on Midjourney, do you have to pay for like a subscription?
Per search, per download, you pay the tiniest fee.
Right.
Like a fraction of a dollar, something.
I use something called Autopilot. Have you come across that?
No.
So that is... It's an AI transcription tool.
Oh, nice.
That links into your Zoom. So somehow I've got it set up in my Gmail. So anytime I set up Zoom calls, this autopilot arrives in the meeting.
That means we can no longer do Zoom calls.
Well, you can see it's there. You can prompt me to remove it for you. So autopilot sits there, listens to everything, does a transcription, and then at the end creates meeting minutes and sends out the meeting minutes to everyone in the meeting. Very, very funky.
The things you can do now with tech and AI, it's actually... What excuse do you have now to not be able to set up a business that you're genuinely passionate about? And when I say passionate, because I think it's quite a cheesy word, a lot of people ask me, oh, Sabs, I want to start a business. Or they'll just message me randomly on Instagram, but I don't know what to do. And I just ask them, what is it that you love to do when you have free time? What is it that you are willing to do for free? That is what you should do a business in.
For people who don't want to start a business, if you can apply it to the job that you're doing to make yourself
absolutely.
A more efficient, you know, more valuable employee, I think
absolutely.
Yeah, everybody's natural reaction to any kind of disruption and any kind of tech is always, well, they'll find an excuse as to why not to like it when really that's just covering up the fear of them losing their job.
Right.
But you know, in the context of video editing, you know, like I was saying to my guys, you know, multiple times at the beginning of the year, you know, don't fight this stuff. You know, that ultimately your competition is a 15-year-old girl using Opus on TikTok, you know, to come up with some stuff. And she, you know, she can bash out at that speed, she can bash out 50 times the output that you can do. But that doesn't mean you're about to get fired and replaced, you know, by Opus and a 50-year-old girl.
Absolutely.
If you, with your education and your experience, can use the same tools that she can use without having any education and experience, imagine the output that you can do. And all of a sudden, rather than you, you know, just being Joe Bloggs video editor doing, you know, two or three edits a week, you can be Steven Spielberg overnight and, you know, make yourself much more valuable.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that you like to set yourself challenges. You know, you like to learn. Mm-hmm. Learning's a key. Pet something of mine. Insofar as I mean, I'm a vociferous learner myself. I think I always was when I was younger, but I probably didn't do it as actively as I would do now. You know, I'd probably accidentally like to learn things in the past, whereas nowadays, you know, I very much set myself out that I want to go and read this book, or I want to take this course, or I want to do the other. And one of the things I hate in people I employ, people I work with, is that, you know, 99% of people, you know, have walked away from learning, or, you know, at 21 or 18, and, you know, they think, you know, once they're in a job, that's it, and they know everything. But I mean, what How do you learn? Where do you get your information? You know, do you like to concentrate on specific things, or you know, do you just love to consume knowledge?
So the way I like to take in knowledge is by looking at the biggest picture possible. I don't go into micro first, macro. So I'm obsessed with the future. I have a weird obsession with the future. Because I think we're all living in a simulation. I'll get into that another time. I'm convinced that we are just in a game, in a computer game. So I'm obsessed with what the future will look like after we're gone. And the way I do that is by looking at history, because I know that history repeats itself. So you were talking about AI, for example. If I want to learn about AI, okay, I'll go on YouTube, I'll go in social media, I'll speak to some experts in the field if I have access to them. But I think that's just surface level learning about AI. If you look at history, look at civilizations, some civilizations have survived, some have not. So what is the future of AI? I don't think we should be discussing jobs. It's way deeper than that. Is AI going to wipe out the human race? We as humans have the power now to wipe out the race of chimpanzees if we want to, but we don't want to. We're happy to coexist with chimpanzees. So maybe we are happy to coexist with AI robots. Or if we're a threat to them, yes, they probably will wipe us out because it's survival of the fittest. So this is where my mind goes. I'm not looking into websites. I really want to understand the future implications of what decisions we're making today. And I do that actually by reading up about history. Ironically, it teaches me the most about the future.
Were you this, I guess, forward thinking as a kid?
I don't know. I think my parents think so. They always call me an alien. And I always felt a bit weird. And when I was younger, I thought it was bad weird. But now I feel comfortable in my weirdness that I can just celebrate it, you know, with other weirdos like you.
I'm an alien too.
I know.
Talking about something more glamorous for a minute. You've been filming some reality TV recently.
Yeah.
Was that your first time on telly?
It was my first time. I believe you're the connoisseur. but it was my first time.
I dated live on
reality
TV.
I haven't done that yet. but should we do it together? No. When I filmed reality TV, okay, so when you're a consumer of reality TV, you watch the Kardashians, you know, whilst you're eating something and you just think, oh, look at their stupid life. You don't realize the work that goes into making reality TV. I had no idea. It's hard work. And it's a lot of thought, a lot of planning. So I really pushed myself to do this. I really went out of my comfort zone. It's so not me. And I loved it.
How did the opportunity come to do it?
So one of my best friends is already on the show. So she invited me to join the cast as a friend of. So I'm in a few episodes. But it really opened my eyes because, okay, say I met you, right, when a year ago in Arts Club. And we got to know each other. We laugh, we joke, we have common friends. But you don't deeply know about me, right? You're learning, and I'm learning today for the first time.
Yeah.
But these people that I was filming with, they didn't know me. So they were asking deep questions about me to discover who I am. So it makes you actually revisit yourself and ask yourself these questions for the first time in, what, 20 years? So I actually got to delve into myself, my development. Who am I? Who is Sabs? Because I had to answer these strangers, because I had to bond with them and get to know them.
And I mean, how real is reality TV?
For our show, it was extremely real. Like, no script. You just never knew what was going to happen on that day, in that morning. It was super real. And, you know, the feelings were real. The emotions were really real. And sometimes I would come home feeling really happy, having a great time with this cast. And sometimes I would have a really tough day because my emotions were hurt. My feelings were hurt.
Do you think you'll do more?
I think so. Yeah. Whether it's this show or another show, I have a feeling that I will be on more TV. I think it suits me because for me, it's almost like therapeutic. I don't know why I find filming TV cathartic. Maybe I just get to, I don't know, let off steam or just chat shit. I don't know, but it's quite therapeutic.
And presumably beneficial for business.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll let you know. I don't know. Let's see. But look, if you look at other reality TV shows, people that have really legitimate businesses have done very well out of it, as they should.
I mean, let's just talk about social media for a minute. Yeah. I mean, how, because you've grown a strong following anyway, and this is before the TV's come out. How have you grown your following? How have you found it beneficial for business? And, you know, I guess what would any advice be for people who are looking to market themselves?
You know, I think social media is such a blessing. People say quite negative things about social media. I learned so much from socials. I educate myself. I get to relate to people. I get access to people. People get access to me. So how I grew my social media following was just being myself, which sometimes can be the hardest thing. My memes, for example, it's just myself. And I comment sometimes on the memes and I make it about me and I say something very, very sarcastic. It's just me. So your followers will be people that align with you. And it's quality, not quantity. I can't stress that enough. It doesn't matter if you have a small following. If they're loyal to you, they will be interested in the business, aka value add, that you have to offer. But what I would suggest is just to definitely get on social media, even if you're shy, even if you're an introvert like me, and just be yourself, because everyone has something valuable to offer.
I mean, when you say about connecting with people, I mean, the opportunity to meet people, and I guess it cuts both ways in that you can't probably meet the people you want to meet unless you've already started to develop some kind of profile for yourself as well. But, you know, the number of times that I might be, I mean, literally 2 days ago, I was watching a podcast where it was literally like probably the world's best paid SEO guy. And I'm listening to this thing, oh, this guy's amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd love to pick his brains.
Yeah, sure.
Go and find him on Instagram, drop him a message saying, you know, listen to this podcast. It's absolutely fantastic. You know, give him a few personal anecdotes about me and say, I'd love to host you on my podcast so we can have a chat sometime. You know, a couple of days later, he replies, sends me his WhatsApp, sends me his email. We start having a chat. I mean, you know, there's no other comparable of where those kind of situations could ever have happened at any other time in life. And as I say, I think you need a bit of both, because I'm not saying I'm a celebrity by any stretch, but obviously, you know, there's, if someone receives a message from me and then probably looks at my profile, it's going to hold better weight than someone who's got no profile picture and three followers. So you do have to work on that side as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, once you've got that, the ability to, you know, to reach out to people and do, you know, a network with people that you would just never get to meet in any other circumstances.
But you know, if you want to achieve that, which is great, what I would suggest, what I've learned, is that just be yourself. Don't try to sell something. Because if I say I open up your Instagram, you really are just you, right? It's so you. You're not trying to be someone that you're not, and you're not trying to sell us your business or your product. You have your podcast on there. You have your family life on there. And some people say to me, they say, oh, why are your podcasts so varied? Why are the topics so varied? Why do you post your dance videos on your Instagram? Why do you post your dogs on your Instagram? Because other accounts are not like this. I said, I'm not trying to sell anything. Mm-hmm. I'm just talking about whatever is on my mind that day. I can't predict what I'm going to talk about on social media that day, because it's just me. And I feel that level of authenticity, people will resonate very quickly. So if you want to grow, that is probably the fastest way to grow.
I think two things I'd kind of add from what you're saying on there is that by being yourself, it allows you to be it forever. You know, if you're putting an act on, then you're not going to maintain that consistency. True. You know, whether you accidentally slip out of character or you get sick of being someone else, you know, you won't be able to have the consistency to get to where you want to go. And a big thing I disagree with as well, you know, on LinkedIn, you always get a lot of people saying, you know, why has that person done this post? You know, this is a business platform. Mm-hmm. This is a business platform. There shouldn't be pictures of kids or talking about what you went to at the weekend. And you know, like you say, if people want to do business with you, you know, they've got to know you, they've got to like you, they've got to trust you. How can you do that unless they see that rounded, authentic picture? And you say, you know, share the dog, share the dancing, share the business, because all of that is you, and it's all your package. And you know, if people don't like you, I say, look, you know, I'm not worried about what people say about me online, because if you don't like me online, then you won't like me offline.
Absolutely.
And if you don't like me offline, we're never going to do business. Yeah. We're never going to hang out. So why do we give a fuck anyway?
Yeah.
So.
I get it.
So what's next?
Tomorrow or next year?
Well, you know, the next big project, the next big business, the next exciting.
I'm at full capacity for my investments for 2024, so I'm not investing in anything until 2025. I've kind of finished everything for the end of this year, signed and sealed everything, and the next year is going to be about putting myself and my brand out there for the first time in my life, because I've always kind of worked quietly behind the scenes, and I almost felt embarrassed and ashamed of what work I was doing because it was different to what my friends were doing or what my family friends were doing or how they chose to live their life. I've chosen to live it in a bit of a rebellious way, you can say, for a Pakistani woman. So I almost felt embarrassed to share what I was doing. So 2024 is definitely about being brave and putting my life out there, because if it can help or inspire other people to have a better journey, a better one than I did, then I would be a very happy person. I would want the next generation to not have to have the same conversations that I had to have.
And what does success look like to you? I mean, if you look back to your 8-year-old self, 10-year-old self, you know, do you feel successful now, or do you think you've still got things you want to achieve?
I actually never think about success. I do think about peace a lot. And you kind of reminded me of how I felt when I was 8, 9. I didn't have that much peace. And I don't think it has to do with finances. I think you can have all the money in the world and not have peace in your life. So my definition of success is peace. Peace at home, peace with myself, peace with my family, and lots of love.
I couldn't agree with that more. I always say that my definition of success is happiness. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you we almost kind of went down that route with the conversation when you were talking about finances, because mm-hmm. when you use the word success, everybody, you know, 99% of people naturally default to, you know, tying success sure. and money together.
Sure.
I always say, you know, if you haven't got the happiness, it doesn't matter how much money you've got and, you know, how many, mm-hmm. you know, if you're a skint person but you're mm-hmm. smiling, then you've already won.
Yeah.
And if you've got a fortune and you're miserable, then, you know, you've got a lot of playing of the game of life to do.
Yeah.
Well, listen, it's been great having you here.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. I've loved learning some things for myself, and I'm sure the audience will be looking forward to part two as well. Just before you go, just let everyone know where we can find you, where we can follow you, and how we can contact you in 2025 if we want some investment funds from you.
Yeah, at Saba Yusuf on Instagram. It's probably the easiest way to get a hold of me. I actually stopped giving out my email address because I was getting too many marriage proposals.
Okay. So. I'll just send it on WhatsApp.
You can do it now on the podcast.
I just want to have a Pakistani wedding.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.